Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
With every success comes more responsibility. With more responsibility comes more exposure. With more exposure comes more anxiety and more imposter feelings, if you like.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Balancing Acts. In this conversation, I talk to author, business consultant, journalist and psychotherapist, Naomi Shragai. Perfect. Hello, I'm Steve Whiteley and welcome to Balancing Acts, a series of conversations with an array of creatives. We talk about their journey, the struggles they faced whilst progressing their career, strategies they use to unlock their creativity, how they balance their career with their personal lives, what impact this has had on their mental health, and lots more. As a freelance journalist, Naomi has written for The Times and Guardian, and since 2008 has been a regular contributor to The Financial Times, where she writes predominantly about the psychological aspects of working life. She's also appeared numerous times on Radio 4. Naomi's book, The Man Who Mistook His Job for His Life, was published by Penguin and came out in August. It's a book that describes how to thrive at work by leaving your emotional baggage behind. And this is something Naomi and I get into, and we talk about the various emotional states that can arise within the workplace and how often the way that we feel and react to certain situations and individuals in our work environments are often due to past experiences and trauma. So it's fascinating talking to Naomi about the book and her experiences as a business coach and psychotherapist. So without further ado, over to Naomi. Perfect. Very good to have you here. I wanted to kick things off talking about when your first career as a stand-up comedian. I know we've previously talked about that. This is you came up with some very well-known comedians. Who were your kind of comrades in arms at the time when you were doing stand-up?
Oh, well, it was a wonderful time to be doing stand-up. It was the early 90s. So on the circuit, we still had Lee Evans, Joe Brand, Harry Hill was regular.
Okay.
Dylan Moran and Arnold O'Hanlon had just arrived from Dublin. Quite a few. The Irish comics were just on board. So it was a remarkable time to be doing stand-up. Bill Bailey was there doing his musical routine. It was a wonderful time to be on the circuit.
And could you see back then, a lot of the names that you just mentioned, could you see back then that they would go on to do really great things? Or were you kind of all at a similar level and you really didn't know what the future held in terms of who was going to be successful or not?
Well, there was just so much talent. Did I know they'd all be so successful? There was so much talent at the time.
Yeah.
I could imagine they were all going to go places. What was most interesting at the time was seeing all these young Irish comics coming from Dublin, you know, one after the other. They were so funny and so talented. And of course, they all went on to be super successful. Could I see it? I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm still seeing people who I met on the circuit back in the early 90s, still doing very interesting stuff today. So they stuck with it and have, you know, done some interesting stuff.
That's part of the key, is just sticking with it.
Definitely. You know, we all struggled. I write about this in my book, of course. I had my bad nights. I write about that a lot because I had many bad nights. And I think, you know, there were a lot of talented people and, you know, a lot of funny people. But perhaps the most crucial thing for anyone is to get over rejection very quickly, because it'll happen. Yeah. You'll have a bad night. And those people who succeeded are the people who just got back on their feet and back on the boards and did it again and again and got better with time.
Yeah. So yeah. What made you decide to stop? How long were you doing stand-up for?
Probably doing it for about 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
And what made me, the reason I gave up at the end, it was so hard to give up. It was excruciating because I love comedy and I love the comedy circuit. So it was a very hard decision to make. But at the end of the day, I just couldn't leave the day job. I just couldn't make a living doing stand-up. And I had another few careers to choose from, and they weren't bad. And they were also good earners. I was a psychotherapist at the time. So I was doing psychotherapy during the day. In the morning, I was training to teach the Alexander Technique. So I was training, I was working as a therapist. And in the evenings, I was doing stand-up comedy. And when I couldn't get enough money on the weekends, I was doing children's entertainment and clowning.
Oh, wow.
So I had all that on the go at the same time. And to be honest, I couldn't keep it up. I tried and tried and tried to make comedy my main thing, but it didn't happen. So I had to let it go, painful as it was.
Was it painful?
It was painful. Yeah. It was very painful letting go of comedy. It was a big loss because it meant so much to me. And I missed it for so long and still miss it. But I still love an opportunity to write a gag and do a routine. I try not to miss an opportunity when I can. So I have to say I haven't given it up entirely.
Oh, that's great. And do you think your time as a comedian informed your work as a psychotherapist in any sense?
Has it informed my, that's a really good question. Nobody's ever asked me that before. In some ways, they seem such, you know, separate, very different things to do. But for me, comedy helped me to keep, you know, to keep light. And, you know, psychotherapy is a very intense experience. So I always felt it was always useful to be doing something else, something more creative, something more light, something more fun, that kind of. And again, your theme being balance, that balance, the intensity of psychotherapy. And that's why I enjoyed it. And that's why I enjoy doing it together.
And now, obviously, you're working as you're an author. We'll obviously get onto the book, coach, business consultant, and you're still obviously working as a psychotherapist. How have you managed to balance all of that in your life? Have there been ebbs and flows over the years?
Oh, sure. Of course. It doesn't happen without ebbs and flows. I mean, with me, balance is a big thing because I'm always juggling so many things. At the moment, I'm currently an author. I've written a book. I'm also a freelance journalist, by the way. I've written for the Financial Times now for 10 years, also for the Times and the Guardian. So I've also done freelance journalism. So writing is a big theme in my life. And also my psychotherapy practice has moved to now I pretty much do work psychotherapy. So I focus almost entirely on doing psychotherapy for work related issues. So I have that on the go, and so there's quite a lot that I'm doing at the same time. So balancing and juggling is always a part of my life.
And did you decide to hone in on fusing the work and experience you've done as a psychotherapist with the business side of things as a result of clients that you'd seen over the years who were emotionally affected or, you know, had been detrimentally impacted by the experiences they'd had in the workplace?
Well, that's right. I mean, if we go back 10, 15 years, so quite a long time ago, I noticed that people were bringing more work-related issues to therapy. And that was interesting to me because traditionally people think about psychotherapy as a place to bring more personal issues, relationships, perhaps breakdowns or depression or illness. And suddenly I found more and more people were wanting to talk about work.
Yeah.
And I had an idea for a feature for the Financial Times. You know, there were quite a lot of men coming along and they were struggling at work. And oftentimes at the peak of their career, they found themselves also with a young family. So here they were at the peak of their career, young children, oftentimes needing to move house or have an extension. All these pressures were coinciding at the same time. So I had an idea to write a feature about fathers struggling to have it all. People were talking about mothers trying to find work-life balance, but I began to address the issue of men's work-life balance. And it touched a chord with readers, and the paper invited me to stay. And I carried on writing features about working for a narcissistic boss and having difficult conversations, why people are terrified of delegating, control freaks, on and on it goes. And so I've been writing these features for the Financial Times for a number of years, about 10 years now. And it touched a nerve with people because, you know, Financial Times, most people think about it as a fairly dry paper in terms of business reports. And at the time, the paper just wasn't writing about people's emotional lives, what was really going on for them at work. And that's what I wanted to write about. And readers reacted quite strongly. And suddenly I realized that there was a real need. You know, people were struggling at work emotionally. They were really being so challenged. And I wanted to write about this and also focus on this in my own work and practice. And then, of course, more recently, Penguin has commissioned me to write a book on the topic. So it's kind of the book is an extension of my work, my practice, and my writing.
Great. It's amazing, isn't it, how sort of only sometimes when you look back, you can kind of trace the steps to how you've got to a certain place in your career. But at the time when you're doing it, you don't necessarily know where something's going to lead to. You do it born out of interest, curiosity, and passion. And then you get to something, oh, that makes sense. That's why I did, you know, that's why I wrote these features. And that led to this. And then now it's led to this point where, you know, you've read this book, which has been published by Penguin.
No, you know, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right to say that. I can't say I ever had a kind of been a plan or an ambition. It was really one thing led to another, really. So it was initially began with the stories my clients were telling me that got me very interested, and then thinking this would be interesting for people to be reading about. And then the paper asked me to continue, and so on and on it develops. But I certainly couldn't have imagined at the beginning that my career would have taken this direction and that I would have written this book.
Are there elements in the book that apply to your own profession as a psychotherapist?
Well, there are elements. Of course there are. I'm writing about people's working lives. So work is work, you know, whatever your work is. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I talk a lot about, one of my favorite topics in the book, if it's okay that I leap in a bit. Yeah. One of the things I talk about a lot is how people's, you know, sometimes their experiences of in dysfunctional families or maybe even early traumas, some of the ways that they have been able to not so much overcome, how have they kind of defended themselves or protected themselves against early trauma or family dysfunction. Those particular strategies they employed are oftentimes behind people's success. So it's a way to look at, if you like, how early trauma or family dysfunction, that the skills we use to navigate them or survive them or overcome them are oftentimes not only inform people's career direction, but actually are sometimes a secret behind why they're so successful. So for me personally, you know, I tell a story about myself in the book, which don't mind repeating if you'd like to.
Yeah, please do.
Well, the story I tell about myself is that both my parents were Holocaust survivors. So they were both, they had both survived Auschwitz, and their parents and families were all gassed at Auschwitz. So I have this, if you like, legacy I carry with me. And my mother was, and they were good people, but my mother was a very damaged woman. And of course you can understand why.
Yeah.
Everything she went through. And, you know, growing up, the only way I could really connect with her was to rescue her. You know, she was so damaged. So I kind of became almost like a rehabilitation therapist to her at a very young age. because I could see how damaged she was. And that was the only way I could approach her. So from an early, early age, I guess I learned that the way to connect with people was to help them. So I became a helper, you know, and I became somebody who really wanted to help people with damaged lives the way I helped my mother. And of course, that became my career. That became my career of choice. That's what I learned. That's what I knew. So that was the beginning.
That's fascinating. Mm. And you touch upon this in the book. You talk about how people habitually confuse their professional present with their personal past. So would that be an example of that? Or are you referring more to particular traits, personality traits that arise in the workplace as a result of their past? But whereas in your case, you are aware of, you know, why you sort of acted a certain way. A lot of people are completely unaware of why they might behave or act in a certain way in the workplace or outside the workplace due to whatever happened to them in their past, because they might have even explored those areas.
Mm, no, that's right. Well, I talk a lot about the book, and the book is primarily about how we confuse our personal past with our professional present.
Yeah.
And of course, most of the time, this happens unconsciously. You know, when we grow up, you know, it's kind of our early family lives leave us with a sort of a blueprint or a template in our minds, and it informs how we perceive really all subsequent relationships. So it colors our perceptions, our earliest experiences. And of course, while we might be aware that our early family lives somewhat inform our more intimate relationships, we might think, oh, my girlfriend's just like my mother, or right, yeah, I can see that I married my father. So we might recognize that in our personal relationships, but we don't see how that plays a part in professional relationships. But of course they do all the time.
Yeah.
So in the workplace, what happens is, you know, everyone to a greater or lesser extent is acting out their personal or their internal dramas in the workplace. Because it informs how they perceive situations. And that's a lot of what I've been writing about. Shall I give you an example?
Yeah,
that might
do.
Help?
Yeah.
I mean, there's loads. I don't know where to begin. Of course, it happens all the time.
Yeah.
But,
I was thinking this is particularly relevant for the entertainment industry. I mean, I'm sure it's every workforce, but, you know, I think this kind of thing pops up very regularly in the entertainment industry. As you can see from, you know, the past few years, in just as specific examples within the Me Too movement, certain behavior patterns that might well have happened or occurred due to whether it be childhood trauma or unresolved issues, whether it's that or something else, it's something that seems to be quite prevalent.
Mm-hmm. You're referring to a lot of the abuse and harassment in entertainment industry and the roots of that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yes. 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 In fact, I had written about that in some time. I'd written a piece about what's behind the Me Too. In other words, who are these men who are harassing and abusing women in the entertainment industry? And why would someone put their, you know, their profession, everything at risk for basically a hit?
Yeah.
And I think that's the question that people should be asking. Unfortunately, what was interesting is not many people were interested in having this conversation then. Perhaps they are more so now, 2 years after it all blew out and over. But I think it's a really important question to ask. Who are these men, and why would they take these risks? And I think we have to understand that as well. Of course, we need to make the workplace safe, don't get me wrong. But I think we also have to ask ourselves these questions if we are really going to resolve this issue about harassment and in the workplace and entertainment. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, these are men who are so deeply harmed somewhere, and they struggle with such deep feelings of shame, and they're desperate for a kind of an affirmation for a woman, really, to, if you like, support the masculinity. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're craving for. And of course, seeking out women who are less powerful than them, or women they have power over, of course, it's less likely that they'll be rejected. It's as simple as that. You know, they can't cope, can't tolerate with rejection. That would just be too overwhelming for somebody with such fragility and such insecurities about one's own masculinity. So they seek out people with less power who are less likely to reject them. And that's the pattern. That's one of the things I see.
And does that type of personality trait tie in with what you talk about in the book in terms of narcissistic personality?
I don't know if these people are necessarily narcissistic personalities, but I can say something about narcissistic personalities if you want to go there. Because I think it's also a term that gets splashed out a lot these days.
Yeah.
You know, everybody, my ex-boyfriend's a narcissist, my boss is a narcissist, everybody's a narcissist. Of course, not everybody can be a narcissist except you.
Yeah. So, but I mean, I feel like because we're living in this age, you know, the Instagram age, where, you know, we can make everything about us and it's all about likes, etc. It does lead to the whole idea of narcissism being a term that's bandied about and sometimes accurately and other times not so much. But I'd be interested to hear more on what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I mean, narcissism is a very popular thing. Of course, Trump's made it hugely popular, and people probably use the term much more than they ever had done. I think people get narcissism very wrong. You know, narcissism is kind of a trait, if you like, but all of us have an element of narcissism. We couldn't function without it. Narcissism is simply self-belief we have in ourselves. So, you know, without narcissism, we wouldn't have that capacity to put ourselves forward, to promote ourselves, to have ambitions to achieve, you know, so it's equally a problem to be low on narcissism, if you like. So it's much more helpful to think of narcissism as on a continuum. And, you know, on a healthier end, it's quite a good trait. I mean, I don't think leaders can be without narcissism because they need to convince people to get behind them. They need to inspire people and excite people. So an element of narcissism is really very healthy. So
that'd be like the equivalent of being a productive narcissist rather than a pathological one.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Precisely. So, you know, productive narcissism, the reason we call them productive is because they get things done. Mm. And, you know, they're oftentimes very intelligent. They're oftentimes very talented. And oftentimes they have the insight. So they know how to manage their selfishness. I think that's the key. It's not that they're not selfish, but they know how to manage it. And they also know this. They know how to rein it in when they need to. So in other words, sometimes they need to think to themselves, I better show a bit of compassion here because that's what leaders do. So I'll do that.
But, so it's not necessarily because they feel that. They don't naturally feel that sort of feeling or degree of empathy or compassion. It's because they feel that's what they should do in order to come across as a sort of likable, normal human being at that time.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. Okay, that's not a big trait. What we say is these are people who have cognitive empathy. So they're smart enough and they can imagine what they should be saying. Got or it. They can imagine what people, you know, that they need to show some empathy because it's good for business. Doesn't mean they feel it. But at least they're smart enough to know when to rein it in, to rein it in. Show some empathy. Go on.
Sorry to interrupt, but that sort of is varying slightly off piece, but it ties into a certain degree what I feel like some brands are doing at the moment with this terminology. I talked about this in a previous episode, wokenomics, where brands are piling in on certain social movements, not necessarily because they believe in those movements, whether it be Black Lives Matter or LGBTQ or any of these things, but because it makes them come across as a more likable brand. And then as a result, they get a more loyal customer base and then that increases profits.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Exactly. So I guess what you're describing is something similar to what I'm saying, that people can have a kind of cognitive empathy. They can think about how people might be feeling or what other people might be needing, but they don't feel it. Yeah. And there's this kind of significant difference. One is more for self-interest, for me, and the other way is, of course, for the interest of others.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Perfect.
Hello, sorry to interrupt in the middle of this insightful conversation, which I'm enjoying, I'm sure, just as much as you are. But I need to give you guys a little reminder. If you like this conversation, this episode, if you like balancing acts in general, then please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it makes the world of difference. And the more reviews we get, the more rates we get, the more people can discover the podcast and we can make it go viral, whatever that means. Okay, back to the chat. What about in situations in work where there might be fear of conflict, but being fearful of any reprisals that happen as a result? So instead of voicing one's opinion, you keep it to yourself. I imagine there's certain workplaces that don't necessarily encourage transparency. So in that type of environment, what does one do to get past a fear of conflict, but also to perhaps try and change that environment?
I think there's a lot to say in what you're asking, so let's kind of unpick it a bit. You know, the first thing I think people have to ask themselves is this kind of fear of conflict they have, do they fear some external threat or an internal threat? So in other words, is the workplace actually a place where any conflict is quite scary because of the potential fallout and where it might lead? Or is the fear coming more, or the threat coming more internally? Does somebody fear conflict because of their earlier experiences in life? Perhaps it came from a family, you see, where there was conflict, might have led to, say, exclusion or rejection or withdrawal of love or even violence and abuse. So for some people, conflict has, you know, quite a, you know, kind of terrifying resonance where it could potentially lead. And they bring that to the workplace with them. So any kind of dissenting opinions, opposing views or conflict for them might feel terrifying because they're in their mind, this is where conflict might lead. So they have to differentiate whether the threat is actual or imagined. Does it come from the workplace itself? Is it really that terrifying to express conflict in this particular workplace? Or is the threat coming from oneself internally?
If they identify it to be coming from a place, you know, internally, what would then be the next step to try and resolve that? Because based on that, it's probably something that's longstanding, like you said, based on past trauma or in terms of being raised in an environment that perhaps didn't encourage conflict or expressing oneself. What would be the next step then for somebody to try and figure that out and almost reconfigure and rewire that sort of fear of conflict?
Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, that's quite a process, but it's a really crucial one.
That's where someone like you comes in.
That's where somebody like me comes in, that's right. Often does. You know, it doesn't have to be me, but it really does help in the first instance to talk to somebody to gain perspective. So, you know, talk to a colleague, an ally, you know, somebody you trust, and check out your perspective. I talked to somebody yesterday. It was quite an interesting conversation. Because this person had feared his boss and thought his boss was a really volatile and abusive man. But when he talked to his colleagues, they had a different take on him.
They said,
he's a bit wacky. He's a bit off the wall and he's quite eccentric, but he's not a bad person. You know, we're not necessarily scared of him, but this person I talked to was scared of him, and he was scared of him because he was so fearful of his own father. His father, in fact, was a volatile man and a violent man. So it's interesting how different people in that particular business interpreted their boss's eccentricity. Yeah. You know, for many, it was just quite fun and crazy and wacky. But for him, it felt quite dangerous. And that was because of his past experience.
And once the penny dropped, was he then able to move past that?
Once a penny dropped, he was able to move past that.
He strolled into his boss's office. Now, you listen here. Sit down, Sonny.
Well, we don't know how far he went. But the important thing was he wasn't scared anymore. He just wasn't scared anymore. So it was a big success. So, you know, getting perspective and talking to people is a very good start.
Yeah.
Really. So, you know, if you're at the workplace and you feel things quite strongly, those are some of the questions you should be asking yourself. Is this actually going on? Is this what's really happening? Or is this coming from me? And sometimes, not sometimes, but nearly always, there's a mixture of both. When we react quite strongly to relationships and situations at work, there might be an element where it triggers something that's unresolved in us from our past or our early lives or our family, mixed in with something that's actually happened. So there's a lot to reflect on. And so I'm always encouraging people to think, basically, to think and reflect more and try to get some clarity on what's happening.
Because everyone sees things through a different lens. And we all have a different interpretation. But then you can get kind of Woody Allen with it and overly neurotic. Well, what was it, him? Was it me? I don't know. What do you think? So it's sort of a fine balance between sort of questioning it, but not over questioning.
Well, that's right. That's right. We do have to let things go. You know, everybody's coming to work with all of their, you know, what I call it, everybody's mishigas. That's sort of Jewish for their craziness. So everyone has their mishigas and they're all coming to work and all this, and everyone's bouncing off against each other.
Yeah.
And we all have to manage it all. So it's never going to be entirely clear. We certainly need a lot of tolerance. You know, we certainly have to appreciate that everybody's doing their best with the mishigas they have, essentially.
That's a good phrase. I feel like that should be a quote on a t-shirt.
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to talk to you about imposter syndrome because it's something that's come up time and time again with different guests on the podcast, and it seems to be a running theme. First of all, is imposter syndrome something that you have suffered with at any points in your career? You know, as somebody that's essentially, as you said from the off, you're somebody who helps others. And are there ever times where you have questioned that, you know, who am I to be giving this advice or helping others in this capacity? And if so, how have you got past it?
Well, you know, everyone has insecurities. Of course I do. I think every psychotherapist is thinking, you know, do I know what I'm talking about?
Right.
And, you know, because we're constantly met with situations we haven't been faced with and trying to help people make sense of them. But, you know, when anyone steps into a new role, what's imposter syndrome? It's just self-doubt, really. So having doubts about how competent you are is perfectly normal. Everyone does it. You know, it really is only a problem if you can't shake it off, you know, after months or years. And it's also a problem if it starts to inform your decisions, your behavior, what you do. You turn down a promotion because you don't think you're up for it when you actually are. So again,
does that tie into the idea then of imposter syndrome being a fear, not a failure, but of success?
Well, I do talk about that in the book. I talk about how, that the imposter syndrome is not necessarily a fear of failure, but can be a fear of success.
Yeah.
And what I mean about that is, at some level, if, you know, people really kind of are honest with themselves and go to the back of their minds, you know, somewhere, failure gives you a kind of a get out clause. And, you know, you think, well, if I fail, at least I don't have to do this.
Yeah.
So somewhere there's a relief in failure for many people too, which I think it doesn't really get acknowledged. Because remember, with every success comes more responsibility. With more responsibility comes more exposure. With more exposure comes more anxiety and more imposter feelings, if you like.
Yeah.
So success brings with it more anxiety. You know, some people think, gosh, if I just reached this point, if I got this job, if I succeeded here, you know, I wouldn't have these feelings. And then they quite surprise themselves, because the further they go, of course, the more anxious they become, because, well, they're more exposed and they're constantly having to be in new roles and do things they haven't done before. And all of them makes them doubt themselves. So sometimes failure can be a relief. Sometimes failure can offer a get out clause. But there's one other thing, you know, if I can say a bit more about how the imposter syndrome can be about fear of success, really. You know, for some people, Funnily enough, that's true for Patrick Marber, who talked about this in a Guardian interview. You know, success for him meant having the success his father hadn't had. You know, his father wished to be a performer, a comedian, a playwright. He wished to be all the things that Patrick Marber was. And so success for Patrick Marber was a real mixed bag. He felt terrible guilt for having the things his father hadn't had. So it's the guilt sometimes of succeeding over one's parents that causes a lot of these feelings too. So somewhere there's a fear of success for many people.
Do you think that with all these things that we've discussed and issues, you know, within the workplace, does meditation play a part in helping deal with overwhelm and anxiety?
Well, I don't talk about meditation in the book, but I am a big believer in meditation.
Are you?
I mean, yeah, I've been meditating for 30 years more probably. So for me, meditation is so much part of my day. I can't imagine what life would be like without meditating, but I don't think I want to risk it and find out. I think I'd rather just carry on. So I'm a big believer in meditation.
What type of meditation do you do?
I practice transcendental meditation.
Okay.
So it's 20 minutes twice a day. It's dead easy. Doesn't take a lot of planning. It's quite simple. And it's been part of my life for so many years. I can't imagine not meditating. But I think, well, you know, meditation, I think the practice of meditation is much more preventative. You know, some people think, oh, I feel so stressed, I think I'll meditate. But it's better to have a regular meditation practice and keep your anxiety down and stress levels down at a manageable level, because then it will take more stress to actually wind you up, if that makes sense. So it's better to practice daily, practice regularly, have a daily routine for alleviating stress. So when you're dealt with situations in life, you're not likely to react as strongly.
Yeah, there's some distance between the emotional reaction and then reacting on that emotional reaction.
Yeah, that's right.
And how have you found this past year or 2 years now? It's 2 years, isn't it? This whole cultural change of people now working from home. How do you think that's affected some of the issues that we've talked about now? Because this is now what's, I guess, the equivalent of being the modern workplace environment, isn't it? This is not something that's just going to go away, this idea of working remotely, and there seems to be both pros and cons to this new work setup. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I think, you know, everybody's thinking, and I agree, that some hybrid solution is probably the way forward. There's a lot of advantages, of course, for working remotely for so many people, cutting out business travel primarily. But I think there's a cost to it as well. And I think people are starting to experience that already. They miss the face-to-face interactions, the spontaneity, the spontaneous conversations, the connections people make. It's very hard to maintain that on video. I think it worked initially quite well, but I think my experience is, you know, in those companies where people already had established relationships, then that could carry on working virtually. But they already had relationships. They had already made those connections.
Yeah.
So if you like, they had some reserve in the bank, and that could take them quite a long way. But that reserve would run out in 6-12 months, and then those connections start to wane, I think, and people actually have to, you know, physically connect and be together. So I think, of course, I'm speaking generally, and everybody has their own unique experiences, but I think that people do need that face-to-face, in the room, in the body, connections and relationships in order to feel that work is worthwhile and that work is fun, you know, those really positive aspects of work. So we'll see how that develops and where it grows. I think people will find different ways to connect and different ways to be close and different ways to collaborate and work together.
Yeah. What do you do, Naomi? What's your recreational activities? I know we touched upon meditation. What do you do outside of your work to relax and unwind?
What do? I do a lot of tennis. I play a lot of tennis.
Okay.
And I do a lot of hill walking. So I like to be moving. I like to swim too. So I like to move. I find it difficult to relax and be still. I like to relax and move, swim, hill walking, tennis, anything where I'm moving and exercise. I feel good doing sport, being outdoors. Being outdoors feels great.
Yeah. It's necessary, isn't it? I've been seeing a sleep coach recently for insomnia. And they're talking about the importance of getting outside in natural daylight first thing in the morning and then trying to do it in the evening just to get our sort of circadian rhythm back to its sort of natural source. But anyway, a slight detour there. And are there any books over the years that you have read that have had a big impact on you, either personally or professionally?
Gosh, so many books. Oh, my goodness. I don't know where to begin. Well, professionally, I've been very inspired and influenced by a Dutch writer and psychoanalyst, Manfred Kets de Vries. But he was the man who really had put psychoanalysis into business and organizations.
Okay.
But I really love his work because he makes it also accessible to people, which is what I try to do, of course. You know, sometimes I think psychotherapy and psychoanalysts can use a kind of a language which really distance themselves from people. But I like the way he talks to people. I like the way he writes. And he's been a big inspiration of mine. He's written, he's written out over 50 books. Can you imagine that? He's written over 50 books, nearly 1,000 articles. He's so prolific. So he's been a big inspiration of mine professionally.
Okay.
You know, personally, of course, I have my favorite writers, but professionally, he's really been a big influence on me.
Okay, great. And final question I want to ask you is, what does the idea of balance mean to you or not?
Well, I think, you know, balance is everything to me. What does it mean? I can't imagine not having balance. You know, another one of my professions, if you like, is teaching the Alexander technique. And that is entirely about teaching people how to use their bodies in balance. So how to maintain a postural balance. But of course, it's not all to do with postural balance, because of course, our postural balance affects our mental and emotional balance. So practicing that and teaching that always reminds me to come back to a balance and how important balance is. So I have to think about balance in terms of body use, but I also have to think of balance in terms of my professional and personal life, and balance in terms of my energy levels as well.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you so much. And your book, The Man Who Mistook His Job for His Life, is out now. And where else can people find out what you're up to? And just sort of get in touch if they're curious about what we've discussed today.
Well, they can look at my website, naomishugai.com, my upcoming events, my latest features and articles and podcasts and all my events will be on my webpage. They can also find many of my articles on ftfinancialtimes.com, and my books available, of course, on Amazon. Most booksellers, is not difficult to find.
Okay, fantastic. Great. Well, Naomi, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Perfect.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.